Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast. A couple quick announcements. All right, as you probably know, we are launching Nerdist at Meltdown. Nerdist Industries at Meltdown Comics on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood.
Right across from Guitar Center, where they're probably having some sort of a bi-weekly sale on Fender Strats.
Saturday, April 2nd, is our first show, Jimmy Dore's Poppin' Politics.
Just added, Sunday, April 3rd, Nerdist Podcast Live with James Gunn.
He is the director of Super with Rainn Wilson that opens this weekend. So here's the deal with that show. Tickets are $10, but if you show up with your ticket stub from any screening of Super from this weekend, you will get in for free. So free show if you have your Super ticket stub, $10 for everyone else. That's at 8 o'clock. And then, of course, Monday, April 4th,
Black Dynamite Night.
This other new show was also just added. May 2nd, Kevin Pereira of Attack of the Show. That will be a Nerdist Podcast live at Meltdown Comics as well. So you can check all this information out at meltcomics.com before we get our calendar up on nerdist.com. So that'll have all the information on the show's meltcomics.com.
And we are through the Looking Glass, people.
The last week and a half before the Boston show at the Wilbur Theater. The tickets have been selling really well, so thank you so much for that. There's still a handful left, so grab them now and beat the lines. Hope there's lines. Ticket link on that at Nerdist.com. All right, that's it. Here we go, the next Nerdist podcast with Mr. Timothy Ferris. A very smart man with a lot of big plans about how to streamline your life and shape up your body. Why am I talking like this? I'm annoying myself.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Yeah. And I'm like, he's like, hey, you want to see something? And he just pulls open a drawer, like his underwear drawer, and it's just like full of like knives and a grenade.
But then what? But then
yeah.
What?
Nice. Yeah.
Then what if he did that and he was like, check out my underwear? Like he
did. Right. I mean, it'd be weirder if there was also underwear in there. Like, you know, underwear, socks, knives.
Don't mind the knives. Check out my underoos.
That's so weirdly specific, raised by his grandparents. I know exactly what kind
of kid. Exactly what kind of kid
that is. Like the kid smells of must.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I had so many of those friends. I had a few of those friends in high school. And yes, that's such a perfect description. You go over there and it just, there were like heavy curtains and the houses always just smelled like, was it that was the must emanating from the curtains or was it emanating from the grandparents?
And mothballs.
And mothballs too. Yeah. Oh, grandparents love mothballs.
Yeah.
They do. Those mothballs love grandparents.
It's a perfect marriage.
They're a lot like those kids like in that one bit you have, that like the kids from Old Sperm.
Yes,
like that's a very similar kid.
I just have a bit that Old Sperm makes really dweeby kids.
Yeah. Well, hey, they don't get better with age. Sperm, that is.
They don't. Mm. I always think, like the way a kid runs in gym class is like the older the sperm, I just feel like the worse they run because it's very, it's sort of
recapitulates their time in the, you know, like getting to the egg where they're just, it's like the tail doesn't work as well and it just kind of flops around, but yeah, somehow they made it.
It's broken a rudder. They got there anyway.
The egg took pity on it, like, oh, I feel bad for this one. Yeah. All right, get in here.
Which is exactly what the mom did when they got married. Yeah. All right.
And oh, you can see the pattern repeating itself over and over again. We're here in the abode of Tim Ferriss. Tim? Yay! Sorry to bring an audience.
That's all right.
It's very exciting to be in your house because I feel like I've seen you had pictures. I've seen pictures of parts of your house from the detective that I've had following you around.
Fantastic.
And they're very high
quality.
He's
been very courteous.
He is. Yeah. He is.
He's a great photographer. The shots are just very composition. Such a good.
He's really nice. Yeah. He's like, hey guys, that old gumshoe stereotype, that's the old days. Yeah. that's not how we roll now.
Oh, no. We're shutterbugs.
But when I wrote a feature for Wired in 2000. I wrote it in 2007 and it came out in 2008. And it was about how I took these three different productivity systems and tried to apply them because I was, at the time, I was sort of self-help obsessed. Mm-hmm. And I realized, you know, I spent so much time in my car in Los Angeles rather than listening to the same playlists over and over again. I'm just going to start listening to, like, improvement audiobooks or whatever, and most of them will probably be crappy, but if I can get one good thing out of it, then it's probably worth it, and it seems, you know, seems constructive. And so then this Wired piece came along, and I reviewed, I implemented your book, and David Allen's Getting Things Done.
Of course.
And then another book called Never Check Email in the Morning. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed each of the authors, and when I interviewed you on the phone, I don't know. I just felt like we totally hit it off right away. You're a comedy fan. You're a normal guy. You know, David Allen and Julie Morgenstern were both nice people, but they were very adult. And it was very.
I tried to postpone maturing for as long as humanly possible.
It was very. They were very. It was very grown up-y. It was like talking to your parents about like why you should clean your room. And then you and I think I feel like we talked for like, you know, 30 or 40 minutes, not even really about the book. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of got to the book, and then so we became pals. So
yeah.
So congratulations on the success. First of all, a 4-hour work week, which I really enjoyed.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah, I'm convinced I'm 14 minutes into my 15 minutes of fame.
So I don't think that's true.
Try to enjoy that last 60.
No, I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true at all, because if anyone reads 4-Hour Work Week or they read the new book 4-Hour Body, you're a guy who is not afraid to just go out and try stuff and experiment on yourself. And, you know, I just feel like if your next thing will just be some new thing that you decide to try, and because there is, you know, an almost infinite combination of things you can do, I don't think you will ever get stale in that way.
Are you going to ever put out a 4-hour nap?
4-hour nap.
That's what I'll probably
do. I hear there's a lot of competition through my connects in the industry. Oh, yeah. I was going to, someone had suggested I do something on relationships, and I said, well, the 4-hour marriage sounds bad. So it would have to be the 4-hour courtship.
Oh,
which I think would be a better seller, but I'm not sure if Americans understand what courtship means.
Like it's like playing with their tits, right?
That's what I assumed that meant. It was suggested.
It's right. Putting the old finger in before you fucking put the dick in, right? That's what the courting.
That's the courtship, yeah. That's a courtship. And that was the collective sound of every woman just turning the podcast off.
It was a parody of how a shitty guy would say something.
I feel like we quote unquote parody that guy a lot. He's a very popular character that we like to go back to. But so when, you know, let's just for us, you know, we'll talk about 4-Hour Work Week a little bit, but
yeah, we can talk about whatever you'd like, man.
Well, we definitely want to get to 4-Hour Body because we all well, Matt and I read it, and Jonah Jonah tried to piece together
use the ransom
program.
Letter approach.
I call it Jonah's notes.
Using Amazon reviews, he tried to piece together.
Oh no, there's an Amazon reviews, just reviews of the book, like on men's health. Ask Men had a blurb on it, and I thought I had it. I really did. I really did.
See, even after I told them you can borrow the book. Like, no, I got it. I got
Adam.
Sold. Done. I got it.
You've been on Amazon. It's like 85 reviews.
Yeah. No, I'm 4-hour work weeking 4-hour body.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I'm using one hack to hack another hack.
Yeah, it's like 2 hours tops.
It's all life hacks. It's all life hacks, you guys. So, what did you initially come up with the idea to do for our work week, which I'm sure is a story you've told to, you know, 50 million times already?
The story really began with a breakup, actually. I had a girlfriend break up with me in mid-2004, closest I've come to getting engaged, and it was because of my work schedule. It was 7 a.m. to 9 p.m.-ish, something like that, because I was chasing time zones, dealing with different countries. And I was oblivious to the fact that that was a problem, which I think is true with a lot of problems. Yeah. I was like, what do you mean you don't like seeing me 10 minutes every other day? I don't see why this affects our relationship. And that was the end. And I realized that time really determined the value of income. I had no plans to be a writer whatsoever. I had a traumatic, extremely traumatic experience with my senior thesis in college, and I vowed never to write anything longer than an email after that.
what was the thesis on?
Thesis was on acquisition of Chinese characters by native English speakers and looking at phonetic and semantic mechanisms for improving that process.
Oh, yes.
It's a big... It's
We've
a big,
all
it's,
been there.
That's actually my next book. I'm thinking of publishing the thesis.
Oh, really?
No. Kidding.
I would get a nosebleed just writing that sentence out. Yeah, the title of the thing.
The nosebleeds were part of the problem.
Yeah.
And so I took a year, or actually a year and a half, to walk about, basically, to travel around the world. And the first 4 weeks were dedicated to getting myself off of email so that I could actually look at my life with some perspective as opposed to just dodging bullets and hitting send receive like a rat with a cocaine pellet dispenser. And that 4 week just ended up being extended because I'd lived my life in 15-minute Outlook increments up to that point. And I said, all right, no more planning, no more calendar. I'm just going to go wherever people recommend I go. And throughout that process, I was still at the time, and I still am now, giving lectures twice a year at Princeton University in high-tech entrepreneurship, which was a class I was a student in 99, I think it was. And I gave the lecture from Argentina when I was there. I gave it via the phone, and instead of talking about my usual shtick about how to build profitable companies without outside financing, I talked about quantifying your ideal lifestyle, really sitting down and defining what that post-retirement or $20 million payday post-lifestyle is, and then working backwards to develop a business model, whether it's a career or startup, to support that. So really approaching it backwards compared to most people who are doing, let's say, retirement-based career planning.
Yeah,
anyway.
And that was one of the main themes that I got from 4-Hour Work Week was, you know, why postpone, and you know, why postpone your, you know, the rest of your life vacation,
right?
Basically, yeah. When what are you going to do with that time when you're, you know, 70 years old,
right?
At that point, why not enjoy it now?
No, exactly. And gave the class, had a lot of positive feedback. It was the first time I talked about what I ended up labeling lifestyle design. Ton of feedback, and one of the students in very Ivy League fashion was like, oh, you should just write a book and be fucking done with it. Why? Like, smiley emoticon. I was like, well, I'm not sure if that was like a slam down or a real suggestion. But
smug Princeton.
I know.
God damn emoticons.
I know. God damn it. So I remember one time I was like, yeah, I'm an alumni. And they were like, alumnus, you mean? I was like, yeah. Yes, that's what I meant. Thank you.
And, you fail for today. You fail for today.
Yeah, exactly. But that planted the seed, and much, much later had time to kill and put together a book proposal just for shits and giggles. And then an author, Jack Canfield, the guy who co-created Chicken Soup for the Soul.
Okay.
I sent the proposal to him. Not many people have heard this part. And I said, Jack, am I full of crap or should I actually do something with this? And it was just like a pet project for fun, really. And he said, no, I think you should. And he introduced me to a few people as potential agents, all of whom turned me down except for one guy who was new as an agent but had been in publishing for a long time, named Steve Hanselman. Went out, pitched the book, got turned down 26 times, and then Crown within Random House bought it, and here we are.
So, wow. Now, do you ever call up those other publishers and be like, slick move, guys?
I haven't called them
up. You get any gloating time?
I've had some gloating time, but it's been very indirect.
Right.
I wouldn't say passive aggressive, but if I get emails that are like, you so deserved it, I wanted to buy that book, but you know, so and so just didn't want to do it. And I'm like, oh, thanks for the consolation email. Have a wonderful year or life. Sincerely, Tim Ferriss. Because the turndowns weren't like, oh no, we like it, but we can't do it now. It was like, I cannot believe you're so full of shit. It was like they were very, Jesus. They were very strong. And those weren't sent to me directly, but to my agent. Like, who is this punk ass frat boy, which I wasn't. I wasn't even a frat boy, really. But I guess I look like one. So people want to punch me in the face when they see the about the author photo. But part of my polarizing appeal, apparently. So yeah, it's been a real adventure. Not too much gloating, but just enough to make my quality of life
better.
You're
owed some gloating.
You get a little bit of gloating. Yeah, yeah. I mean, how did you grow up? And I mean, because you're obviously a very methodical person.
Yeah.
I mean, you were. We had dinner maybe 8 months ago, and you were trying to explain to me how you learned Turkish in like a week.
Oh yes,
you were explaining to me. I was like, I don't even know if I would ever consider that might be a possibility for me. I'd probably just be like, well, here's my train of thought. I'm probably not gonna learn Turkish. Eh, fuck it. I'm probably not gonna go to Turkey now.
Yeah, I'll just stay here.
Yeah, I think a lot of that behavior stems from early wins, and part of that, if you look at the things that I've tried to deconstruct, there is a high frequency of failure within all of them. Like language learning, a lot of failure. You're not going to get good at a language without making a lot of mistakes. And I do think that very early on, I was, big surprise, hyperactive kid. And I was born premature, had my left lung collapse, had a number of health issues, and I was really small. So I couldn't compete in any sports, couldn't finish the presidential fitness tests that they subjected every kid to.
Me. Like,
yeah. Oh, man. I was a mess. Like, I had horrible allergies. The only sport that I could participate in was wrestling, in a kiddie wrestling program, because it was weight class based. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'd wrestle the whatever 4-year-old girl, I guess, at the time. So I was so small. And ended up inoculating myself against failure, in a sense. I started viewing mistakes, failure, as feedback really early on because of that.
Wow, that is incredible. I mean, that's just not something that most kids know to do.
Yeah, and I think also in American culture in general, it's a medal for everyone's society. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually really bad for people. I think that it does not prepare kids in particular for the real world. If it's like, hey, Johnny, you didn't do that well. You're actually horrible, but we're going to give you a badge. And you don't need to try any harder.
It doesn't prepare them for those rejection letters.
It doesn't prepare them for, like, who the fuck is this punk ass letters.
Yeah.
And then they get one of those and they're devastated and they don't pitch the 27th publisher. And I think my parents were also very good at just exposing me to a lot of environments, meaning whether it was aquariums or going to the beach or going out in nature and letting me find things I was interested in and then just facilitating the exploration. They never pushed me to learn French and count to 10 in front of their friends or whatever, which is pretty common. I mean, that's happened to many people I know, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, but I never developed an aversion to learning because of that, except for math. One math teacher fucked me up, and part of the reason that I went to the school I did was that there was no math requirement. That was actually a major factor in my decision.
Yeah. Well, math is dumb.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it.
Ironically, why I went to the high school I went to, they had no gym.
Yeah, well, there you go.
And I didn't go to college, so it all seems to happen. Well.
So where did you go to college? Oh, you went to Princeton.
Yes.
And so what is Princeton? What is Princeton like? Is it as snooty as everyone says? You know, like, is it snooty as the, not everyone says, but is it snooty as the, as
no,
the
it's
impression
everyone.
That I have?
Is it as snooty as The Simpsons makes it?
Right. Yeah. I would like to say it isn't, but I think it is. Mm-hmm. I had a few amazing experiences there. There were a number of professors I never would have had access to otherwise who were just incredible, like John McPhee, who's won at least one, maybe two Pulitzer Prizes, was able to do nonfiction with him. Then Kenzaburo Oe, who's Nobel Prize winner for, I think it was either Literature or Peace Prize, I don't recall, did a class with him. And those are opportunities that I wouldn't have had otherwise, and they had a big impact on me. But collectively, I found the administration and the culture to be very conservative. Mm-hmm. And while they were doing some groundbreaking things in a few isolated areas, very stodgy and stuffy. And I did not have the best experience there. I really didn't. I think that I probably would have been happier, but it's always easy to speculate, had I been at, let's say, Brown, where a lot of my friends went, or Stanford, perhaps. But I don't regret having gone there. I learned a lot, but so I get hit, which is amazing to me, since they have like a $15 trillion endowment. But, you know, I get hit by fundraising letters and calls all the time.
which is still mystifying to me. I'm just like, what are you guys doing with your 13, 15 billion? Like, I want to know where that's going first before I write you my $100 check or whatever.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And, but there are the Eden clubs at Princeton. And a lot of people aren't familiar with the Eden clubs. They're fairly unique to Princeton, maybe one or two other schools. They're co-ed fraternities, basically.
Okay.
But this is what makes them a little unusual. There's one street called Prospect, and there are these huge mansions that line the street on either side, and each of those are eating clubs. And so you can either sign in to some of these eating clubs, and they all have their stereotypes. Like, there's one for the computer science guys. There's one for the football players, and you know, softball players are like banging football players. And then there's one for the lacrosse players and the lacrostitutes, which they were called.
Lacrostitutes!
Yeah, because nice. Lacrosse was the big, like, the baller sport. And you can sign into some of them, meaning first X number of people to sign in get in. Then there's what's called Bicker, where you have to have anywhere from, let's say, 5 to 10 interviews to get into these clubs.
This is something rich white people do.
No, yes. Yeah. And it was, there is one eating club where all kind of the, I'm not going to say misfits, but in a positive way. People who don't fit in cleanly into one of those categories go, and it's called Terrace. They have a big rainbow flag out in the front. It's like all the punk rockers, all the LGBT.
The Delta
folks.
House.
Yeah, the Delta House, exactly. And so I ended
like
up
the best one.
I ended up at Terrace.
Yeah.
Ultimately, and I give money to Terrace, I don't give money to Princeton.
Now, what is an eating club? You like,
yeah, so you pay an obscene amount of money to eat there. So for the first 2 years, you have residential colleges, just like any college. You eat at a cafeteria.
Mm-hmm.
Past, at the end of sophomore year, you can either go independent, which means you have to cook your own food. So I was out. I mean, I tried that and gave myself food poisoning. We'll get back to food poisoning. Gave myself food poisoning within a week because I cooked. This is awesome. I had a rice cooker. I'm like, oh my God, rice cookers are amazing. You can just cook whatever and you just let it sit in there. And so I made this meal with like rice, tuna, egg, and I was like, oh, you know, I don't need to refrigerate that. I just let it sit for like 2 days and got so violently ill. Oh, it was horrible. So I decided.
I'm glad you told me that because I've always, you know, like if something sits up for a couple of days, I always go, I wonder how long it would take to get sick.
Yeah.
It's pretty quick.
Yeah, it's pretty fast. Apparently, like tuna and eggs and rice and water, you don't want to let that sit too long.
No. Okay, good talk.
So you pay money, you eat your meals there. It's basically you can either cook your own food, go to a co-op, which has its own culture, which is a little unusual at Princeton anyway. Not bad, but different. And then you can go to these eating clubs where they have professional chefs who make meals. And I ended up at Terrace.
Wow, this is a whole separate social stratum that I never even...
Yeah, so I've heard rumors like some of these eating clubs. I don't necessarily believe this, but I could see how the number would be staggering. There's one club called Ivy where F. Scott Fitzgerald, JFK, a lot of the Blue Bloods tend to go, and it's not, you know, you can't... I think that blaming someone for being a Blue Blood is kind of stupid.
Right.
So they're not, yeah, just like you don't choose to be born poor. If you're born rich, then who the fuck cares? But a lot of Blue Bloods go there. Okay. And I've heard that the endowment of Ivy Club as an eating club, this has been repeated multiple times, which doesn't make it true, is as big as Brown University.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. It's crazy. So I'm like, again, why do you need, you know, why does Princeton need my $100?
Yeah, yeah.
Could you give that to Guatemala? No.
Yeah.
No.
We need better gloves for the servants.
We need gloves for the servants.
We're paying by the grass blade. That's how it's done.
But the crepes are fantastic.
I mean, if we're going to talk about it, really, I mean, they melt in your mouth. Yeah,
and I mean, I had friends at many of the different eating clubs, but you can see it's very stratified, and I think that's true in all of human society, but it's particularly stark at Princeton.
Did everyone at the Terrace, was that the one you went to?
Yeah.
Was everybody really kind of in it together? Like, it's like that communal, none of us fit in. Everyone understand that? Like, you said there was like punk rockers and gay and lesbians and
there was a pretty strong cohesion in that group because of that.
That's really awesome.
Which was cool. And and even still, when I go back to Princeton, I will go and hang out at Terrace. And nobody gives a fuck. Whereas if I wandered in like the weird, they'd be like, who's the weird grad student? You know, like, why is the old guy here? Almost anywhere else, I'd feel really uncomfortable. I can wander in there and I chill out and nobody gives a fuck, which is cool.
Yeah. Which I from what I hear, that's rare to find in college where they're just like a group that brings you in because you're different.
Yeah. Pretty, especially at a place
Princeton.
Which, I mean, it's an amazing school, but I did not have the best experience there.
But then after school, did you start traveling right after college?
No, I came out here. So I ended up in the Bay Area because my professor in the high-tech entrepreneurship class invests in a lot of startups. He was formerly head of IBM Data Storage and did all this, a whole assortment of things. I mean, he was a congressman, competitive figure skater. It goes on and on. Yeah, I know, right? Pretty unusual combo. And I came out here to work at a startup, which was a mass data storage startup called TrueSAM, Storage Area Network. So I was trying to sell huge server configurations paired with fiber channel storage to DreamWorks and companies that have that type of need. There goes my music.
Dance break.
Now you got to sing. You got to sing whatever you were going to say. And all these data storages and megabyte stuff.
Megabyte stuff.
Should answer this phone call.
Fiber up. Hey.
Yeah. You know that guy?
Yeah, I do. I don't really know him that well.
Oh, Mr. Kevin Rose has made a telephone cameo.
I don't think I've ever. I'm not sure if I've ever actually spoken to Kevin Rose.
Yeah, he's a good dude.
On the phone before. But
I came out for Fiber Channel, tech startup, make my billions, because one of the acquaintances who was a few years ahead of me, Jared Polis, had sold Blue Mountain for $600 million to Yahoo or something like that. And we were all like...
They're doing great now, right?
Yeah. I was just looking at it. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, the general consensus was, all right, Jared's very smart, but $600 million? All right, like, I have to give this a shot. And so,
600.
Yeah, exactly. And not 600,000. Yeah, not $600. 600 million. So this whole army of grads came out to Silicon Valley right before everything just imploded, and I was one of them. And then after that company is when I ended up getting into the sports nutrition stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's what took me to the 7 to 9 p.m. work schedule, I guess, 4 years later.
Did you know, as a kid, when you had the health problems, are you over? Clearly, you're over all that stuff now because you're...
I still have left lung problems.
Really?
So, yep, I still have impaired lung capacity to a large extent. The biggest issue with the lung problem and I had my blood transfused. I think it was my entire volume of blood 4 or 5 times I was in the intensive care unit. And it screwed up. This is my theory, at least, because I've suffered heat stroke a few times, and I've had to go to the hospital and so forth. And I think it screwed up my thermostat, like my hypothalamus. So if I go to, I've been to Burning Man twice, and I left early this year because I could just I do not do well in the heat.
Wow.
And
so that's why you stay in San Francisco.
That's why I stay in San Francisco. Yeah.
But you travel a lot, though.
I do. I have to be careful about the heat, but I still have some residual problems from that.
Now, see, if you can get into shape. Yeah. And you have impaired lung capacity. Yeah. There's no excuse for anyone.
I would hope not.
Well,
yeah. We can explore that. But so I have really, really horrible endurance related to this and a number of other things. So I'm going to be running an ultra marathon in the next 6 months, and I've never run even a 5K.
The hell's an ultra marathon? Is that 52 miles?
It's just longer than a marathon. Whatever's longer than a marathon, I'll be doing about. I'm not going to be going too crazy. I'm not going to do 100 miles. I'm going to do 30 miles, so about 50K, roughly. Which for me is impossible. I mean,
I think it's impossible for most people. Yeah.
So I want to try to do it. Yeah. And I'm going to let everybody follow my training so that I'm extremely shamed if I don't do it. Yeah. Which is a good way to ensure that I actually take it seriously.
So that's actually an interesting point. So do you feel like it's important when you're goal setting to make yourself accountable to someone other than yourself?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It's far more effective, I think, than the... Far more important than the actual method you choose. Whether you are trying to quit smoking, change your work behavior, or lose weight, or gain weight for that matter, I think if you were to, let's say, use an iPhone to take a photograph of your food before you ate it, in the case of the gaining or losing weight, and post that publicly, and post your progress on a weekly basis to, let's say, a wiki. These are things that readers have done already, to a wiki so all of your friends can shit talk and you can shit talk back, and there's some consequence, then the outcomes are always better. If I were to split, let's say, 100 people into two groups, you have 50 who are going to follow some very regimented, sophisticated, diet, let's say the zone diet, but a strict zone diet. Mm-hmm. And they have personal trainers and they're going to be training 4 hours a week. And then you have the other 50 who are just going to be taking photographs of their food with their iPhone before they eat their food. I would actually vote that the iPhone group will have a higher rate of success.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting, because they're being held accountable to their little...
Yeah.
So it's social, it's like social like repercussions.
Yeah, the repercussions. It's like, because if you have a job and you don't perform your job, you get fucking fired. So in most cases, that's a pretty strong incentive not to fuck up. But if you follow a diet and you fail, if it's limited to you, there is no real consequence except for some vague future health, which doesn't motivate anybody.
Or it's but what I think happens when people
future health will have jetpacks.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. But what I think happens is that when people set goals for themselves and then they don't make themselves accountable to anyone and then they don't achieve those goals, I think on a very deep level it just puts another notch in there. Yeah, I guess I'm not ever going to do anything.
Right.
And so I think it's important to really try to break, to try to move past that.
Yeah.
Because the more times you do that to yourself, the more I think you just sort of set up a pattern of like, yeah, I don't finish things. I mean, I totally used to be that way.
Yeah. I also, there's so a few things related to this, I would say. For the last few years, a friend of mine, another Chris, we have assigned each other New Year's resolutions.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, we've assigned each other New Year's resolutions, and we have to, or we come up with our own, but we need approval from the other person. Because if it's not a big enough goal, here's the issue. So let's say that I find that bigger goals are actually easier to achieve mm-hmm. for many people, and you can look across literature. There are ways that you can look at this scientifically, but keeping it simple, and let's use a 4-hour workweek example. If your dream goal is like, okay, I'm going to take a week off and go to Florida versus I'm going to take a month off and go to the Mediterranean and sail around. Mm-hmm. At the first stumbling block, you will be more likely to quit if the goal is the less inspiring the goal is.
Oh, that's really interesting. Make sense? Yeah.
And if people are like, I'm going to lose 20 pounds, let's say. Okay. First of all, I don't think for most people that's a big stretch. It's not enough to really inspire people to go through the suffering that is inevitable whenever right. you're making any type of behavioral change. On the other hand, met someone 2 days ago. Their goal was marathon. And then it's a measurable, very measurable timeline driven goal, which is really important. There's a deadline. And then they lost something like 150 pounds as a result of that performance goal. I always have people, if they're trying to change body composition, have a performance goal and a body composition goal. So it's mm-hmm. a performance goal and then an appearance goal. So I think that having someone keep you accountable is the way, as one example, that I overcame my inability to swim. I mean, I couldn't swim. I had this acute fear of swimming because of my lung. I'd had near drowning experiences on a few occasions. Could not swim 2 laps in a pool without completely panicking, having my heart rate jump to 200, mm-hmm. hated swimming. And I was in Brazil with this Kiwi buddy of mine, and he's an amazing swimmer. His whole family grew up on the water. They're all good at swimming. And he said, look, man, swimming is a life skill. Number one, you want to be able to swim with your kids. Number two, it's a survival skill. Your goal, this is before we had this formal like assigning each other goals. He goes, all right, your New Year's resolution is an open water 1 kilometer swim.
Oh, wow.
And that's like, okay, all right, fine. If that's my goal, and he's like a six double espresso a day kind of guy, I was like, all right, if that's my goal, your goal is nothing stronger than green tea for a year.
Oh, wow. A year?
For a year. And he's like, okay, fuck it. You're on. And we both held up on our sides of the bargain.
Now, I would imagine quitting that much caffeine at once was really
funny. What was really funny? Okay, I'll laugh at my own stories.
Right.
Just to continue,
constantly.
So I went to visit. I went to visit this buddy in Australia at one point. He was living in Sydney, and I heard this horrible noise during the night. I was just like, I thought it was some like cat in an alley having some type of health issue, and it was just this horrifying, like, oh, horrifying noise. And I get up and later I'm just wandering around the kitchen making my, I'm like, what is that? And I look, and there's a green tea pot, And there's like 5 pounds of green tea pressed into this pot. And I see my buddy later. He's like, yeah, I don't know what happened. I got so sick last night. And I was like, did you like drink tea leaves? Is that what you did to yourself? He's like, yeah. And I'm like, you're kind of missing the point of this whole exercise.
As he's eating a brick of green tea. I don't understand.
Yeah.
So it was challenging for both of us. I failed multiple times trying to learn to swim. And it wasn't until a buddy of mine named Chris Sock introduced me to something called total immersion, which is a particular method that I clicked and within 10 days fixed.
Now, what are the basic tenets of total immersion?
The basic tenets
of water.
Yeah, get in the water. The basic tenets of total immersion are don't kick harder to fix swimming, which is universally the first suggestion that almost any swimming coach makes. Like, here's your kickboard, go kick. And I would get in there and I'd flail around. I wouldn't even move, which is pretty embarrassing and demoralizing. So don't kick harder. You're actually going to be focusing on streamline right, streamline left, which just means swimming on your sides. Mm-hmm. You're not at number one. Number two, you're not trying to swim on top of the water in freestyle because the body's denser than water. You're going to expect that at least 90% of your body is going to be underwater. So when you're swimming, your head is going to be effectively underwater, except for when you breathe. And you focus, instead of pulling, you focus on driving your arm down and in front of you.
Okay.
It's pretty unusual. So it's like if this were the water here, let's just say you're lying on top of the water, that's the straight line, your arm would be angled down almost at 35, 40 degrees below your head, which is very counterintuitive. Mm. But the water pressure on the arm raises your legs up, so you're more hydrodynamic. And I went from not being able to do 2 laps comfortably to doing 40 laps a session in about 10 days.
Oh, wow.
And without any stress, relaxing. It was just insane how quickly the change.
I don't want to be a dork about this, but I think there's a good metaphor there. There's definitely a good metaphor about how, you know, when you feel like you're under pressure, your kind of panic reaction is, like to fight harder.
Yeah.
Rather than just to like, okay, I'm going to let myself fall into this and then just figure out how to glide through it.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the other recommendations of total immersion, and I think this applies to a lot of things, is don't try to work out. The goal is not to work out. The goal is to practice.
Mm-hmm.
And those are two very different mindsets. Like the goal isn't to exert yourself so you get out of the pool with your heart beating at some insane rate. The goal is to get out of the pool having performed a certain task with as little effort as possible. And I thought that was also just philosophically and practically really helpful, almost meditation that transferred to a lot of other areas.
Yeah, it is interesting to I think specific. Really specific, good goal setting language in your head is very, very important. Whereas, and I'm sure I've said this on the show before, but I have a trainer whose goal is, you know, you have to leave feeling better than when you came in,
right?
Which is a slightly different goal than I'm going to crush you every time you come in.
Yeah.
And ultimately, the result is still the same. I'm exercising and working out, but I'm just a little more into, you know, it's a little more. He calls them pro you decisions.
Yeah.
Which is really kind of what they are.
Very affirming.
You know, they're pro you decisions. So you don't have to torture yourself, you know.
Well, really early on when I was doing a lot of the physical experimentation, I trained a few of my friends. This is when I was still in college. Because I had some pretty phenomenal results with gaining muscle and so forth in college. But I was very early on in looking at the behavioral change side of things. And so I would bring my friends in. I'd be like, okay, I'm going to train you. And I would just destroy them. Just like, they'd be like, oh my God, I can't walk. I feel, oh Jesus. And I'm like, all right, well, you have 2 days, so eat up. And everybody dropped out because I was just like, they'd be like, I haven't worked out in 2 years. I'm like, no problem. I'm going to make you tough and just like destroy them. And I've completely reversed that approach because the little changes are what last. And so if you try to have someone change more than one behavior at a time, let's say if you're trying to teach people over the age of 50, let's say quit smoking by texting, fail. Because those are two new behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
If you try to fix exercise and diet at the same time, fail.
Mm-hmm.
All the time. And instead, like my dad, to use my dad as an example, he was 250 at 5'6", roughly. He was exactly 5'6", but roughly 250. Right. His height didn't change much. And
he would go between 5'4 and 5'7".
Yeah, you know, his height was... Right, right. He lost ultimately more than 90 pounds of fat and gain 20 to 30 pounds of muscle. It started with primarily eating 30 grams of protein within 30 minutes of waking up. That was the change. I was like, I want you to focus on this one change. Mm-hmm. That's it. You don't have to fix the rest of your diet. You don't have to fix your exercise. Forget about all that stuff. Just fix your breakfast. You can't postpone breakfast. It can't be coffee and then breakfast an hour later. 30 grams within 30 minutes of waking up. So you simply used a Myoplex shake to do that. And you went from 5 pounds. We'd already made a few tiny changes, but layered it one at a time. He went from 5 pounds of average fat loss per month to 18.75 pounds after that one change. And those are the changes that last, because you get this tremendous amount of positive feedback. And you're like, shit, that was easy. Mm-hmm. And that's how people need to respond to those initial steps. Wow, that wasn't as hard as I thought it would be.
Yeah, it's one of the things that, I mean, one of the things in the book I'm writing is all about incremental change and about how, you know, when someone decides like, okay, I'm going to get into shape, I'm going to start working out, and they try to tackle it, you know, 4 or 5 days a week.
Yeah.
It's like, no, go 1 hour a week.
Yeah.
Because what'll happen is after a few weeks, you'll start to feel better and you'll go, well, why don't I just do 2 hours a week? I mean, it's kind of like what we did on this podcast. We started at one episode a week.
Yeah.
Feeling like, oh, 1 hour a week, we can cover that. And then once we sort of figured that out and realized it was kind of fun, we're like, oh, you know, doing an extra hour a week's not that big a deal, so let's just do two.
Yeah.
So, you know, I agree with you 100% that the incremental change is absolutely the way to go, rather than trying to – it's just too overwhelming to try to change everything at once.
Yeah, I also think that it's important – it can be helpful to try to strike a balance between – or a combination of – very high goals, very big goals, but very low expectations. So your long-term goal is something big, like running a marathon. Your short-term goal is, I'm going to go into the gym and 10 minutes twice a week. Mm-hmm. That's it, literally. Like 10 minutes twice a week. That's it. I get on the treadmill for 10 minutes. If I walk, fine, whatever. If you go in and you decide, you know, I'm going to keep on going, and you do 30 minutes or an hour, that's fine. But in order to win, to have that early win, mm-hmm. all you need to do, since you've set the expectation that it's 10 minutes, is satisfy those 10 minutes.
Absolutely. And your brain will register that as positive reinforcement. You get to sort of check that box in your head and go, hey, I did it. I achieved – because I don't think your brain necessarily quantifies things – in that way, it just knows that you intended to go do something and you did it, and that's a success.
Yeah, and there are people who have studied this stuff really methodically, like BJ Fogg at Stanford, at their persuasion lab. It's really well established. And so my mistake for a long time was thinking that it was all about the method. I have the perfect method, here you go. And the perfect method doesn't do you any good if you quit it in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Which is why, let's say you look at something like Atkins. Atkins is really effective for fat loss. The problem is people will travel or they'll have a holiday and they will break that diet and then say, fuck, I broke my diet. Okay, well, I might as well just pick it up in a week. And then they regain X amount of weight. Then they attribute the failure to the diet and then they go back to square one. Whereas if you make a slight tweak to that, I mean, we can talk about the slow-carb diet later.
Oh, yes.
But if you make a slight tweak to that, like adding in legumes and beans, and then you have one cheat day a week, like today's my cheat day, hence the chocolate croissants and mm-hmm. everything else, it's sustainable. And so the approach that gets you 80% of the results but can be sustained for years at a time is much better than the approach that gets you 100% of the results but has a 90% dropout rate.
Yeah.
So...
yeah, I think people, we do kind of have an all or nothing. It's very, because you know, the gray area is very difficult to wrap your mind around.
Yeah.
Like, well, you know, like we are in this sort of 100% society mindset. But like, yeah, it's okay to get a B sometimes.
Yeah.
Getting a B is better than getting an F.
Yeah.
So, you know, go a little easier on yourself.
Yeah, I think as long as you're directionally moving in the right direction. That was the Department of Redundancy Department, but like Chinese women in China. No, I appreciated that clarification. The
over the podcast, that's right. Yeah.
If you're moving directionally positively, that's what's important. So the people get depressed, like, oh my god, I just measured my body fat and I'm 30%. I don't give a fuck if it's 30%. I actually don't give a fuck if that 30% is accurate. As long as it's consistently accurate or inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go from 30 to 27, it might in actuality be 34 to whatever. It doesn't matter. As long as you know the direction you're headed.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, because we all try. I you
when I had dinner with you 8 months or whenever it was 8 months ago, and you said, "Yeah, I'm turning in the final draft of this new book that I'm writing," and you know, it's I did all these weird experiments on myself, and some of them almost killed me, and yes. This has been a really intense experience. You were talking about 4-Hour Body,
mm-hmm.
And then I hadn't heard anything about it, and then I was at this gym that I go to sometimes, and I was talking to a guy there, and he mentioned your book. He was like, "I'm so excited, you know, like next month that Tim Ferriss's new book." And I didn't bring you up first. Yeah. We were just talking about, you know, programs and stuff, and he said, "I'm so excited, you know, this new Tim Ferriss book is coming out." I'm like, "Oh, the body book?" And he was like, "Yes, do you know about it?" I'm like, "Yes, of course, yes, of course." And so you sent me the book, and but I just bought it on the iPad because I was traveling at the time, and I started doing it, and my girlfriend started doing it, and I blabbed about it to these guys, so they started doing it, and I enjoyed the program. I enjoyed the cheat day because I feel like if you're just sort of passively eating shit every day,
yeah.
You don't even appreciate it. You're just fucking shoving shit in your maw. But when you can, but when you know, like, oh, Saturday's the day that I can eat whatever I want. Yeah. You really, really appreciate it as much as possible.
Yeah.
So I think we should start. I want to start with Jonah because Jonah did the piecemeal.
Yeah,
almost like. Yeah, I walked down Market Street, and then I just I heard a couple of people talking about stuff, so I just kind of assembled a thing, and then that was the program.
Yeah, I mean, I had a date where I wanted to lose like just some weight by, yeah. And you know, I had started working out again, and because I got to a point where I didn't have the time or the brain capacity to work out, and then like I was like, no, I got to fucking force myself, so I started doing that, and I was like, you know, I also got to do a diet, so. Chris mentioned that thing, so I kind of looked it up, but like I was like, that'll do. That's this information. Not a lot of carbs, beans, you know, stuff like that. And the thing that I've always had problems with is the five small meals because I find myself like running around all day trying to do stuff, and like to stop and eat is never really something I think about. It's like, you know, I have like a banana. And a coffee in the morning, and then around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I have a way too big of a meal, and then want to take a nap, and then it gets to be about 9:30 at night. I'm like, oh fuck, I forgot about dinner, and then I have like, you know, a burrito or something. And that's pretty much the way it was going. And so when I started with the small meals and like all the meat, and then like I was stressing out about what I could have and couldn't have, and you know, just realizing that. Like I was just eating meat all the time, and I started feeling really really salty, like really salty.
He had this glazed
in a literal
look
in a literal sense.
Yeah, like literally, like I felt like dried up. And
you
like
were curing yourself.
And all these different people tell me stuff. Like my friend Paul Bonanno was just like, it's like, oh, it's kind of like the paleo diet. You should do this. I'm like, oh, all right. And then like this guy is like, well, it's kind of like this. Do that. So I started getting all these other things, and like I remember I got food with my friend Boyd. And like it's like they put down fruit in your diet. You can't eat fruit, which is fucking retarded sounding to me because it's fruit is from the earth.
Of course,
it's nature's candy. It should be delicious.
<It's nature's- laughs>
Which like I never appreciated until like I just like I went to a place and I got like an egg white omelet and they put down this fruit and it had everything. It had melons and blueberries and a kiwi and strawberry, and I was like, and he just grabs me. He's like, you can't have that. And I'm just like,
wait, who is this?
My friend Boyd.
Go Boyd.
Yeah.
Like,
he just grabbed it and put it across the table, and I probably would have grabbed it back, but I was so weak and weird from this whole diet that I was like, that's a stuff, huh? And I was working out, and like, you know, there's like you said, I was just doing too many changes, and like, and stressed about it, like not only like it was like work stressing me out, but just this diet, and like it was all I could think about. And my girlfriend, she's like, you know, I'll do it with you. And all we talked about online at work all day, like, you know, IMing back and forth was food. We talk about food, and it's like, fuck, you remember the remember those donuts from, you know, like that place down the street? You remember the chai latte shake from Cafe 101? There was just like all these things that we just fantasize and wake up, and then like, you know. I get up in the morning and I love sleeping in, but then like I would just be like, oh fuck, I gotta get up and eat, and then you know, just everything about it was fucking up my day and my life. And I was constantly talking to these guys, just like, I don't think I,
Oh, I couldn't form words. I was just like,
you're like a weird zombie.
Yeah, it was really weird. And like, you know, my mind's racing, and it's just like I feel dry, and I was trying to drink water, and like I just, I didn't like it. Felt weird. It felt like I was
salty's not a good feeling.
Yeah, like and then leading up to it,
your
like,
sodium intake is probably like 8,000.
Yeah, it was probably, and then like my, and like it's like, and I'm eating like, you know, like, you know, like I love red meat, but I also love chicken and everything like that. But
grass fed.
Like, yeah,
grass fed chicken.
Meat.
Grass-fed meat.
Yeah. But, like, I was just, you know, getting to a point where it was just too, it was getting too much. Yeah. And like, my girlfriend, she's like, maybe not as much meat as we've been eating. I'm like, what the fuck else am I going to eat on this thing besides meat? There's nothing else. Well, I got to fucking refried beans again. Like black refried beans. Which is like, was, and then,
and that's when you develop a taste for human meat.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I wish. But then, like, you know,
very salty.
I fantasize about gamey. That. I bet it's awesome.
I bet it's gamey. You bet human meat's gamey. Yeah.
So then I get to a point, and then like, a Saturday rolls around, and like, I'm just out of it. I'm like, I gotta go to the gym. I don't feel like going to that place right now and seeing those guys, you know, working out. Like, I just need to, like, so I'll work out with my friend Ed, who's a very fit guy, very in shape. And he starts making me do these, like, you know, sprint lunges, like, straight up this hill.
Sounds good when you're hypoglycemic.
Yeah. It's like, and, like, I'm like, I don't know if this is good for me right now. And he's like, come on. I was like, no, you work out all the time. I don't. Like, you know, I don't. This is not what I do. He's like, you could keep up. And he's, like, insanely winded from these. And imagine how I am.
Sounds like he trains people like I used to train them.
That's exactly what I was thinking about when you were talking about your friends. And, like, he's like, come on, you can fucking do it. I'm like, no, stop yelling. Also, during this thing, I felt like I was on the, every time I was by myself, I felt like I was on the verge of tears. Not because I was sad, but like my body would just be like, like, it would just make me, everything.
Why are you doing this to me?
Yeah.
I need to transcribe this and put this on the back of my book. And
but, then, like, you know, and then I have like chicken for lunch after I work out. And then I had beef from this barbecue place. And then that night, I think it was just a culmination of this, like, this diet that I was fucking up. You're like, you know, your perfect plan just ruined by me. Your diet utopia fucking sullied by my fucking...
But don't you... But my guess, and I might be wrong, because you know much more about this than I do, my guess for you was that you weren't eating enough vegetable carbs, that you weren't fueling your body enough, because in the past, I tried to just eat meat and nothing else before, like that crazy Atkinsy thing, and I always felt sick and out of it, just like you do, because you know, your carbs are your fuel, and so if you're not getting that through your vegetables, then you're just going to be tapped out, especially if you're working out like you were.
Yeah, I thought I was. I thought, like, you know, like, I would just fucking dust entire bags of celery and carrots, which do nothing but make you fantasize about food that's good. You know,
it's like, I don't recommend the celery and carrot bags.
They're pointless. They are pointless things. They should only be given to people trying to quit smoking, to do something with their hands and mouth. They do nothing for your body or your fucking stomach. It just makes you like fantasize more about food that would be good to eat.
So what was his main? What
would be my diagnosis? Well, I would say that, let's say you go out and buy a bottle of aspirin, and instead of having two aspirin, you eat half a bottle of aspirin. It's important
is
not
that bad too.
It's important to not blame the aspirin in that case. I would say
we're lazy. We would blame the aspirin.
I'd say a few things. The multiple small meals is something that has infected the recommendations I made. I actually don't really do that. I have pretty big meals.
So that's great. Eating is awesome.
I love it. The diet is not intended to be punishment. It's actually intended to be very sustainable. So I have three or four big meals a day. Well, where I would have started was just changing breakfast. That's it. And then doing the rest of the stuff as you were. Probably the biggest mistake that people make when they're doing this is, rather than eating lots of dense vegetables, whether that's lentils or like asparagus, broccoli, etc., they're doing leafy vegetables plus like a chicken breast. And especially for anyone who's active or on the bigger side, you're going to feel fucking miserable if you don't get enough food. You're going to feel terrible, because what happens is your body's not quite burning fat effectively. It's still using carbs, but you're not getting any carbs. So you just feel like you're starving all the time. It's not a good feeling.
Yeah.
And you get really, really foggy. So you end up on this diet actually eating not necessarily bags of celery, which sounds horrible.
Yeah, it's the worst. It's a pointless thing.
But eating, you do eat more volume, because if you go from, let's say, having a chicken breast and a baked potato, let's say the baked potato is 300 calories, just hypothetically, it's somewhere around there, to leafy vegetables, you just dropped your total meal calories by 200,
yeah,
250. You are going to be hungry and feel really horrible. But yeah, fixing breakfast, I usually start people off if they're just going from, especially if they're starting from ground zero, meaning that they haven't been exercising, they haven't really been watching the diet, I would start people with get rid of, let's say, dairy. Just get rid of milk even. Like, you can do cream because it's lower lactose. Mm-hmm. Cottage cheese, if you like that kind of thing. I don't particularly like cottage cheese.
I love it.
Okay, well, then that's fine.
But I don't drink straight-up milk. Yeah. And I've been training myself to enjoy black coffee
more. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So if you just made the switch, take the milk out of your coffee. Check this out. It's amazing. To me, at least, it's astonishing is maybe a better word. So we tracked hundreds of people doing this, and we noticed even if they made, I said, eliminate milk, and they said, well, all I'm having is a little bit of milk in my coffee, and I have two cups of coffee a day. And I said, all right, eliminate that and replace it with cinnamon. Just like put some cinnamon in to flavor it. If you want to put in some, like, that's a little fine. Bit of cream, that's fine. And if you do that, we saw consistently an additional 2 to 4 pounds of fat loss a week. Just by making that one swap.
See, that's my biggest addiction is that my literally only addiction I have left is a chai latte.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if I have two or three of those a day because I'm running around so much, I mean, that's not only like 30 grams of sugar per thing, but it's also, it's mostly milk.
Yeah. And the issue there is not only are you getting the sugar, but the milk, not, I don't want to get like super crazy about the technicalities, but milk is tricky because on what's called a glycemic index, so the amount that it affects your blood sugar, it can be relatively low. But there's a separate index that people don't really talk about much, which is called an insulinemic index. All that means is when you drink milk, even a little bit, it makes your insulin skyrocket as if you injected yourself with insulin. And if you combine that with, let's say, the sugar in a chai latte, well, boy, I mean, that is the recipe. If I wanted to make lab rats fat, that's what I would do. The rats, they're greedy. They love their chai latte.
You just had this weird, like, I want to be a villain. No one's had fat rats, so I want to be that guy. Tim is a guy who had an insulin monitor.
Yeah, an implant. I might even have another one here that I could show you, but I actually, right at this table, I have a video of me implanting a glucose monitor in my side to watch this stuff. And a lot of it's very counterintuitive. So even if you're going to have a binge day, let's say. So the devil, I mean, the it's really important to read the full program.
No, I'm a player. Like, please, everybody listening, I've seen it work. I've seen your program work. Just buy the book and don't suffer the same fate.
Yeah, I mean, it's $13.98 at the moment on Amazon, and it is the second most expensive expense in the average lifespan in the U.S., I've heard. But, like, for the $13, just please read the details or – no, don't go online because it's full of everyone who has a strong opinion about it.
Yeah.
But if you have, let's say, binge day. So today is my off day.
Right.
So I'm going to have chocolate croissants. I'll probably have a pizza later, wild nettle pizza with egg on top, which is fucking amazing. Yes. Probably have an affogato, which is like the espresso with ice cream. Delicious. I love that stuff. And I had some fresh squeezed grapefruit juice just before I came to meet with you guys because what I saw by having this implant in my side was that if I had some grapefruit juice, like a glass of grapefruit juice before my binge started, it kept my blood sugar stable. And which is fascinating. Now, does that mean that you want to have the grapefruit juice every day? No, because the answer also is that the sugar, and this is why the fruit comes into it, the fruit in the United States or that's imported is designed, I mean, it's engineered to have as much fructose, this fruit sugar, as possible, which is converted preferentially by the liver into fat. It's just, it's like the most effective sugar to convert into fat for the most part. So you don't want to have it every day, but on your binge day, it's really helpful insurance. And it's just like, just knowing that, it's like, okay, cool. I'm going to have a little bit of grapefruit juice, like with my coffee or whatever. Mm-hmm. Not combined, but the wording's important with the recommendations. Don't combine them. Really effective for minimizing fat gain if you're going to have an off day, like on Christmas or whatever. Really, really effective. So,
what was the stuff that you had your dad doing in the morning? Like, what was he? It was like a shake or something?
So, I knew that my dad, like me, is if I say wake up, cook eggs, and have spinach, and he's not going to do it. And and if I'm running around or I'm booked deadline, I'm probably not going
to
do it either.
Yeah, because sometimes like you know, like I get up in the morning and then just I have enough time to get ready and go to work.
Yeah. So what I would do with my dad used a Myoplex shake, which has a lot of preservatives and garbage in it, but it tastes pretty good. So it's like, look, it doesn't have to be perfect in the beginning. I want you to start this behavior, and then once it's second nature to you, all right, a month later, we can go to unflavored whey protein, which kind of tastes like ass, but it's better for you.
Yeah.
Like, we'll go there later, but I'll start with the stuff that has some preservatives and all that shit in it. I don't care. Like, a month isn't going to kill you. And so I would just go get ready to drink Myoplex, which are 40 grams of protein or something, and you just keep those in the refrigerator. You wake up, first thing, you pop one open, you don't pop it open, then shake it. Pretty awesome to have slow motion.
Yeah, yeah.
Replay of that, but
really healthy hip hop video.
It takes 30 seconds, and that's your 30 grams.
And so Myoplex, is that like a SlimFast type of?
It's an EAS product. It was used mostly by athletes. Just a protein shake.
Okay.
I would not recommend Muscle Milk for a host of reasons, but if you can get a Myoplex or something that just doesn't have as much crap in terms of fillers in it, the easy thing is just get a Myoplex. It tastes pretty good.
Yeah.
And stick with that for a month, and then after that you can do something else. Okay. But that's what I had my dad start with.
And he lost
almost 20 pounds in the first month.
Without doing anything else.
That was the only change that he made. Now, for people who really want to lose, let's say 20 or 30 pounds or more, I say start with the diet first, because exercise, quite frankly, does not burn a lot of fat. It just doesn't. And if you want to lose fat, focus on the diet. Do that for 4 to 8 weeks until you're like, oh, this is easy. Because you have your default meals, just like everyone has default meals. When I tell people, look, you want to rotate the same few meals in the beginning, they're like, oh my God, that sounds so boring. There's no variety. And I'm like, what have you had for breakfast for the last week? Tell me. And they're like, well, I woke up and I had this. And then I had the same thing the next day. And then I had the same thing the next day. I'm like, look, you're just having another set of boring meals.
I don't know. Cocoa Puffs does not get boring.
Yeah, Cocoa Puffs, chocolate-covered sugar bombs.
Yeah.
they are delicious, unfortunately. Yes, but I would say that starting off with the diet and then you can bring in the exercise later is really effective because this is where the magic of data comes in. Because we track so many people, and this I think is one of the big differentiators between this book and a lot of the books that have come out in the past, where it's sort of like opinion, but I have one citation, this mm-hmm. works. It worked for me. Instead of doing that, I'm like, all right, we looked at a few hundred people and almost everybody plateaus between weeks like 10 and 12. And they get really demoralized. And if you don't know that's coming, you'll quit. Mm-hmm. Or a lot of people will quit. Instead, I'm like, look, hold off on the exercise. Focus on the diet. You're going to plateau around week 10. Add in the exercise. And then, boom, you kill your plateau.
Mm-hmm.
And it works. It works really well.
And you, Matt, are you still doing the slow carb diet?
Well, I stopped. I got sick this week. So I kind of stopped this week.
Mm-hmm.
But I will pick it back up
again. It's like a cold day.
Yeah, it was like a gnarly cold. And
everyone's had something. Yeah. Everyone had something that was going around.
Floored me. And then
everyone's been doing that thing where they'll...
taking so much Robitussin, I was like, well, you know.
Robitussin's slow carb.
You're snorting. I've been feeling like a lot of people doing that thing this week where you shake their hand and then you go, hey, how's it going? They go, yeah, I'm sick. Like, you just touched me. How the fuck would you do that?
I told you guys before. Yeah. I would shake anybody's hand, I would say, that I was sick. But anyway, no, yeah. Breakfast I found to be the easiest thing to do.
Yeah.
Because I don't mind waking up. Because I'll make egg whites and turkey sausage and cottage cheese. Yeah. That's my breakfast.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's a good breakfast.
But I'm fucking tired of Chipotle and their goddamn bowls.
Yeah, you can get and I think what I may do pretty soon is just track what I do when I go out to eat, because I can go to a French restaurant and change pretty much nothing. I mean, the only thing I'll do is if they bring the bread basket over, like, nah, no bread.
Yeah. I ask you this.
Yeah.
How bad is Splenda? Because I do like...
Okay, Splenda. Yeah. It's funny you should say that.
It tastes like sugar because it's made from sugar.
I just put out a tweet. I scheduled a tweet last night to go out today.
Look at this guy.
Yeah, I know. which referred to Splenda, because there was a... In the book, I talk about how Splenda and the Splenda lobby has flipped out about this, but
I read
not too surprising.
I read this.
Yes. So how it negatively affects your digestive bacteria. And multiple examples, someone just put up a comment on the blog and they said, I thought I was doing everything right, but I like sweetening my coffee with Splenda. Mm. switched from that to I think it was just saccharin, and immediately started losing weight.
So saccharin being sweet and low.
Saccharin being the pink packets. I believe that's sweet and low. Might be aspartame. I would stay away from aspartame. But okay.
What about stevia?
Stevia. So I would say it's better than the other options. The problem is with commercial brands of stevia, they're almost always cut with something else. They're very tricky about it. Hmm. So they'll say, "Oh yeah, it's a stevia product," and they're like, "Oh, but we did put in a little maltodextrin," and but we did put in a little just to make it taste better,
just a little bit of cocaine
because everybody needs a little.
Yeah, come on, a little pick.
Oh, actually, let me ask you about you drink
the worst one. I know. Yes, I do drink.
Yes.
If that weren't clear from my bullet bourbon bottle full of water,
I realized that's a great idea for a water bottle.
The worst sweetener that I think you could use, besides pure high fructose corn syrup, would be agave nectar, which people view as very healthy. Okay. Stay away from agave nectar; it's almost pure fructose.
Okay.
Drinking.
Yes, I'm a large drinker. I'm a fan of it. I like it a lot. Yeah. But I know the standard: stay away from beer.
Yeah.
Because it's just bread.
Yeah.
Which is tough, but yeah. What do you go for? Do you just do straight up booze and on the rocks? What kind of? Are there certain boozes more?
He likes red wine. If you read the book, you would know.
I like red wine. There are drier wines than others. I will also. I do like bullet bourbon. I do like others. The more you drink, the less fat you'll lose. I mean, that's pretty straightforward because the liver is really important for fat loss.
Yeah.
But let's just say you're going to drink anyway. What are the better options? The better options would be something like a dry red wine, or you could do something like what's called a NorCal margarita, which is it's actually really tasty, and it gets you drunk really quickly.
I'm listening.
Yeah, so it's like not only are you a cheaper date, but there's less of a hangover. It's a pretty clean hangover as well.
What is this magic you speak
of? What is this magical elixir?
What's Merlin? Need I visit?
This is called the Merlin Margarita.
That's not a bad idea. NorCal, it's clumsy. But this is a Rob Wolf invention. He's a paleo guy. And it is the juice of five limes.
This sounds like a potion already.
Yeah,
and the juice of five limes and a newt's tongue.
I know exactly.
The eyelash of a bald eagle.
You swing a dead cat over your head at midnight. Five times clockwise, four times anti-clockwise.
Oh, and just reanimated the dead. Yeah. All I was trying to do was get drunk really fast. Five times. Ah, yeah. Shit.
Yeah, yeah, I heard it. There, you got to read the instructions, just like the slow carb. So you put in the juice of five limes, splash of soda, and high grade tequila. That's it. And it's a good drink.
it's a simple drink. Yeah.
The lime juice will lower the impact that has on your blood sugar, if any. Oh. All right. The carbonation will get you drunk faster.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great drink. I mean, you could have four or five of those, and you'll. Well, I don't know what your tolerance is. Maybe you're more of a professional. My tolerance is decent. I do drink,
yeah.
But if you have three or four of those in a short time span, you are done. Like you're satisfied with your state of drunkenness. Cool. At that point.
Slow carbs for loco.
Yeah. But the NorCal, anything on the rocks is just about fine.
Just about, yeah. Just
yeah, good. As long as there aren't mixers. If you're going to be using anything like a Midori, it's going to cause problems. Yeah. But if you're sticking to, I mean, I have some rum. I have rum here. I have I have tequila. I usually save those for the cheat day.
Yeah.
And cheat day all goes. I mean, you could have as much beer as you want.
Let me ask you this: sugar free Jello, no good.
So sugar free Jello. No, these are good questions.
These are things I need.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So sugar free Jello.
I can drive myself crazy.
So the best thing you can do is use the least damaging alternative, right? So I view diets like harm reduction, you know? So I have a friend who does – she's an advisor on the sex hotline. And people call up and they're like, look, I have this weird fetish and I do all these damaging things. And she knows they're not going to change their behavior. She's like, all right, well, let's just do harm reduction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a valuable
– smaller heels when they step on your balls.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Just – yeah, more surface area.
Yeah.
Use the platform shoes instead of the stilettos.
Yeah.
So in this particular case, if that will prevent you from binging on other things late at night, then go for it. Yeah. I used sugar-free Jell-O when I was on really strict – Atkins-like diet, yeah. something called the cyclical ketogenic diet, which is a
it's not a, rolling off the tongue like Atkins.
Not yeah. as tra- yeah. The branding is not yeah, as strong.
Decker. He died of a heart attack.
So I would say it's fine. The like the let's say Splenda or shots. The more you have, the less fat you lose. But if you're still directionally moving in the right direction, who the fuck cares? It's fine. Yeah. So I've used it. What I would say is,
say you have a sweet craving.
Yeah.
What do you do?
I would have sugar-free Jell-O would not be a bad option.
Yeah.
Because it's also not that dense.
Yeah.
It would be better than having 30 ounces of Diet Coke, for example. Right. I am a complete Diet Coke whore, as you may know from the book.
My mom is insane about Diet Coke. Yeah. She just can't. I don't really. I only drink water and chai lattes, and I've tried to start moving over to, you know, I've been sort of substituting green tea for some of the chai lattes because coffee makes me sick to my stomach. I can't drink it.
Yeah.
Even though I should
try yerba mate.
Yerba mate?
That is, if you want to talk about an amazing elixir, that is my favorite stimulant beverage of choice, would be yerba mate. Amazing.
It doesn't send you into the fucking panic attack clouds because it makes your heart beat so fast, does it?
No. No, I have other things for that.
Okay.
it's a melon.
For the sweet cravings, they're actually, I have a very, very good recommendation. There's something called branched chain amino acids.
Okay.
They're not expensive. BCAAs. I use a brand called Dimetize. They're not expensive. You get them on Amazon or any GNC. And what's amazing, they're usually used for weight training. But what's really cool about branched chain amino acids is if you take a handful of these or a couple of these throughout the day, let's say at each meal, your body can convert it into just enough glucose to satisfy the sugar cravings, but no more. It's really pretty amazing. So for people who have sugar cravings, this is particularly problematic, very problematic for women. The branched chain amino acids are pretty amazing. And that was actually a recommendation that I've borrowed from a guy named Arthur Devaney, who's, I believe he's a professor of probabilistic mathematics at UC Irvine. The guy's very smart. He's 70-something. Can still run, it's like a 5.0, or I think he actually said 4.4, which I find hard to believe, but 40-yard dash. The guy is amazing. Like, he looks like a Greek statue.
He's not a crazy vegetarian or anything?
No. He's basically a paleo guy. But his recommendation for the sugar cravings was the branched chain amino acids. And they will also help with fat loss in other ways. So I would say if you use those and then that failing, the sugar-free Jell-O.
Yeah.
The other thing is just to have a really big meal as your dinner meal that has plenty of good fat, and that will usually stave off some of the sweet tooth behavior, because there's physiological, then there's the psychological, and the psychological.
I didn't have a sweet tooth until I tried this fucking diet.
Well, once you take it out, that's when you realize,
whoa,
I
need a cinnamon roll.
Yeah,
this business.
Yeah. The branched chain amino acids are really helpful.
And then on my cheat day, I was like, perfect, gonna go get a cinnamon roll. Yeah. Had one, boom, started sweating immediately. I was like, sugar, the first cheat day.
We meet again.
The first cheat day is a little rough, but rough. I sometimes think about, maybe I'll just be a vegetarian, because I feel like I know enough vegetarians who are older and they look fantastic.
Don't do it.
Don't do it. I would also say with my diet is probably by volume 60-70% vegetables, which is actually more, and we're looking at actual nutrient dense vegetables, than many vegetarians who treat potato chips and French fries
as vegetables. Spanish olives. Can I have Spanish olives?
Yes.
Good.
I think this is good because, a lot of people listen to this podcast. Maybe some of them are struggling with weight issues. So I think the lesson here is whether or not you get Tim's book, The 4-Hour Body, which I recommend that you get. You can get it on Amazon. I got it on the Kindle app for my iPad.
It's lighter on the Kindle.
It is a little lighter on the Kindle. but I would say if anyone's struggling, then, and I guess this is something that we took away for Jonah is just change one thing. Just change your breakfast.
Yeah, 30
grams.
And try that
for a while. And then you don't have to change anything else, and just see if you notice a difference.
These, I will say, these pants are a lot looser than the last time I wore them. because I like to wear shorts in Los Angeles, but apparently in San Francisco you can't do that.
It's a little cold.
it's cold freezing. Up here. But yeah, and I think the breakfast helped, because that's what I eat for breakfast now is egg whites and turkey sausage and cottage cheese.
Yeah, me too. I've been getting breakfast at the 101 Cafe, and
egg white omelet.
Yeah, I get an egg white omelet with spinach and mushrooms, and then a side of black beans and some cottage cheese, and it's really like everything all together. And they don't have turkey sausage, but if they did, I would
get it. Delicious. I will say, just a side note, assuming the eggs are from a good source, meaning
a chicken vagina.
Right. As opposed to
they're not human eggs.
You don't want cow eggs.
Yeah, no, you don't want cow eggs or snake eggs.
But eggs
assuming they're not fed some bullshit and that they actually get outside and like eat what they're supposed to eat, meaning insects, etc., then eat the yolks. You'll actually lose more fat with the yolks.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I haven't thrown one egg.
I don't know if I could ask the tattooed covered hipsters working at the 101, dude, did this chicken eat insects?
Is it safe to assume that if it's free range, they have eaten insects?
There are. The wording gets really dicey.
Yeah.
Because the wording is really abused. But if it's.
The coops are on an open range.
Yeah. I think it's like pasture raised. The wording does get tricky, but. This comes back to the sugar-free gel. It's like, do the best you can. Yeah. And a couple of yolks from Safeway aren't going to kill you. You will lose more fat with egg yolks.
So go to Whole Foods.
Yeah. Or
free-range chicken.
Yeah, exactly. Or if it says, like, omega-3, they have also, like, omega-3 enriched eggs. That would also be helpful.
So I'll use the cartoned egg whites, and I'll get some regular eggs. I'll make some.
And I bought from Whole Foods a men's multivitamin.
Mm-hmm.
But then I also, my girlfriend has calcium, potassium, magnesium supplements. Yep. So those are pretty good too.
Calcium, potassium, magnesium are great to use on this particular diet, especially in the beginning when you're just getting used to it. With men's multivitamin, I would just make sure it does not have iron in it. I would stay away from that because most men don't menstruate. Last I checked, and that means one of the.
Then what is this blood?
Sometimes I get in a mood, though.
Matthew, you're becoming a woman today.
Men in particular, one of the theories related to why men have a shorter life expectancy on average than women is that we take more risks. Is that we don't eliminate toxic byproducts of iron.
And we hunt.
Good read, especially more and more every day.
That's really interesting. I'll check to see. I don't know if it has iron in it or not.
Yeah.
But we're almost at the end of our hour with you. But I did have one. This is going to be. Hopefully, this isn't a too big of a question to ask at the end here. But you're a guy who, you know, especially if anyone follows your blog, which is really fantastic, and
Thank you.
Do a lot of great video stuff on there. And if anyone who follows everything you do knows that. Anything that you decide to do, you have a very systematic way of going and figuring out, breaking it down, and problem solving.
Right.
So, do you just have a kind of a basic set of rules or ideas for whenever you approach, just so that people can apply to anything? Like, what's your problem solving approach if you want to learn something?
Sure. The general approach is find the best people in the world. Which is not that difficult to do if you know how to use Google. let's say in the case of swimming or running. So I'm getting ready to do this ultramarathon. So I go out and I find the best ultra runners. He's pretty good. Go out and find people like Scott Jurek, who's an amazing ultra runner. Go talk to those people. Ask them who the outliers are. Who are the anomalies? So the best in the world, let's say Phelps or Jurek, they're built for their sport. I want to know, who's the 230-pound guy who runs ultras?
Okay.
Where's he and how does he train? Has he trained other people? Is it replicable? So I always look for the outliers. If there's, let's say, I'm going to be learning Arabic next month. I'll be in the Middle East for the first time. Great timing, of course.
You're doing some stand-up dates over there?
Yeah, exactly. Especially looking like American History X. I'm very excited about my interactions.
Could we be whiter?
Yeah. So I'll be learning Arabic. And to do that, I am trying to find the outliers, people who have learned Arabic very quickly. And the way you find those people, or the methods that allow people to do that, is by contact. It's very easy. You don't have to be well-known.
You're on a watch list now? You're Googling, how do you learn Arabic quickly?
Yeah, right. I'm already on so many watch lists. Ordering chemistry kits via Amazon. Oh, I'm on every watch list.
Wow.
Just back in the day when I had the Anarchist Cookbook when I was like 12.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that put me on every watch list.
Yeah.
But... I will call, let's say, the director of Islamic studies at UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm. Get and, Rosetta Stone.
Yeah, generally pretty. I do not recommend Rosetta. Apparently, I didn't know this. I got a call from Time Magazine at one point when Rosetta Stone was having their IPO, and they said, We see on Wikipedia that you are a known critic of Rosetta Stone. It was apparently on Rosetta Stone's Wikipedia page. And I was like, well, it's true. I had no idea I was on Wikipedia, but I'm glad that's how you're sourcing your leads. in any case, I always look for the outliers first, and then I would try to talk to those outliers and ask them, what are the biggest wastes of time, the most common wastes of time among novices? What are the most common mistakes of novices? What are the most common mistakes among advanced? And it's just a series of 8 to 10 questions. It doesn't take that long. And you can really, really learn a lot at that point. Or you can also ask them very practically, and I do this, say in the case of running, I would say, okay, you have me. Here are my basic attributes. Here's here's what I have. You have 8 to 12 weeks to get me to a 50K race. You have 8 to 12 weeks to get me to functional conversational fluency in Arabic. What would you do? $1 million prize. What do you do?
And they always have, I assume they always have an answer.
It might take a while for them to formulate it, but then they'll have an, oh, sure, absolutely.
And you find that these people are willing because they appreciate
$1 million.
And sharing, sort of sharing their knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you express a genuine interest and you're polite about it, which is, I think, a lost art, but given the interwebs.
And so once you have this information, then how do and you apply it?
But it doesn't have to be, let's say, the best in the world. It could be the best person in your county, in your state.
Mm-hmm.
It's not hard to find these people. And it's not about having Phelps personally coach you. But if you find someone who is, let's say, on the Olympic trial, went to the Olympic trials,
mm-hmm,
10 years ago, who was in your backyard, fantastic.
Probably better. It's better than you. He knows more than you do, right?
Yeah, and a very practical approach to take is to contact people who are not currently in the limelight. So if you want to get advice, like I did for my first book, I wanted to talk to best-selling authors, people that had New York Times bestsellers. Worst time to get in touch with those people is when they have a book on the New York Times bestseller list.
Right.
Wait until they're 3 years out, maybe feeling a little bit neglected. and it's not a bad thing, but it's like wait until they're out of the limelight. And they still know exactly what they're doing.
Sure.
And then you talk to them. So for that reason, if I want to learn how to run, I'm not going to contact whoever's at the top of their game right now. They're not going to. I'll have to go through 15 agents. I'm not going to get to them.
Right.
But would it be hard for me to find somebody who was, say, an Olympic silver gold medalist 8 years ago? Nah, not hard at all. Easy. Super easy.
That's great.
Yeah.
And then you take that knowledge and then you just. Do you feel like
testing it out?
Yeah. And do you feel like people tend to overtrain or over, you know, like, when you're learning Arabic, are you going to study 8 hours a day? Or are you like, you know, I'm going to study an hour before I go to bed because that's the best time to try to learn?
Depends on the subject matter and what the learning curve looks like. With anything physical, whether it's swimming or running, the most common mistake I would say that people make is two mistakes. Imitating the common, so whatever's most popular, is almost always not the best approach. Mm-hmm. Number two would be too much volume. So they want to fix the problem with brute force.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, biology tends to respond really poorly to brute force. Mm-hmm. It's not a good approach. With something like language, I find that the density of practice is extremely important. So I will do almost no practice before I go to the Middle East. The only thing I'll focus on is learning the writing system. I will learn how to read Arabic so that I can teach myself.
Okay.
As best possible when I get there. And then I'll definitely be doing 6 to 8 hours a day of Arabic, without exception. Now, that wouldn't all be through sitting in front of a book. It would also be through practice. There's training, then there's practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's true in sports. It's also true in language.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to test things in real-world circumstances.
Talking your way out of a prison there, for instance.
Right, you know. I think I'm actually really excited. I'm going to be going to Jordan, which, from what I understand, is very safe. And perhaps Lebanon, Beirut, also I've heard fantastic things about. I will not be going to Egypt on this trip. It's about testing assumptions.
Well, I love it. And one of the things that's so inspiring about what you do is just, you know, you just decide you want to do something because it interests you, and then you just fucking figure it out. which you know, it's like now I'm sort of at the point where people are starting to ask me, how do I do stand-up? Or this guy last night was like, how do I do a podcast? And I'm like, well, you just do it. You just you buy a recorder, start talking to someone. But what's it about? Well, you have to know what you like. Like, you have to know what you're interested in. And once you can figure that out, then just do it.
Yeah.
You know?
And I also think that as it relates to that, attempting to teach whatever it is really helps you understand the subject matter. And it helps you improve your own performance.
Mm-hmm.
So if I know, as a matter of fact, even if I only have 5 people reading my blog, but if I know that after my Arabic experience, coming back to this accountability also, that I'm going to write a blog post about the process,
mm-hmm.
I will have better results.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah. So
if you have that's sort of a good back burner goal, like that whenever you learn something that and altruistically, this is just a good thing to do, is that you're going to pass that knowledge on. That's kind of an interesting way to approach it.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you even have a very niche readership, let's just say it's a blog or listenership, part of the reason that I still blog, because it's an investment mm-hmm. of time, is because of the feedback that I get. So I put up this post on how I learned to swim. This is why people are like, oh my God, I can't, why do you read your comments on your blog? Like, you're the 4-hour work week guy. I thought you'd have people in India doing that. And I'll give you a very real world example of why I read my comments. When I put up my post on swimming, it was during the Olympics. This is when Phelps Mania was going on. And within the first 20 comments, or maybe 50 comments, I had suggestions from the national team coach. I had suggestions from a former silver medalist. And that type of feedback is amazing. So if you attempt to learn something, you teach the people who don't know as much as you do, you will also attract the people who know a hell of a lot more than you do.
Mm-hmm. Looks like they have a Google alert set up for learning to swim.
Yeah. I'm gonna comment. What I had Chris Anderson from Wired, not the TED conference Chris Anderson, but Wired's Chris Anderson, and we talked about you, and Chris said, you know, Tim, and he said this in a very complimentary way, but he was just like, Tim's one of those guys, you hear about all the stuff he does and you just think, what is this douche's problem? And then you meet him and you realize he's the genuine thing. Like, he really is, he really is a good guy, and he's passionate about what he's doing, and he really cares. And we talked a lot about your piece, was it a video piece about just sort of shrugging haters off online?
Oh, right. I did a presentation called How to Deal with Haters.
Yes.
In Next Web, and then I did a blog post, yeah.
Yeah, and it was we actually kind of worked through it because, you know, Chris and I were of the impression of like, look, we're evolved people, we're educated, we know how the internet works, yet we still get fucking whiny when someone's like, fuck you, you suck. And we're like, come on, man.
Right, right.
And then, you know, and we used you as an example, like we used that as an example. And I mean, cool. I'm sure with some of the claims that you're making and some of the things that you've gone through, of course there are people online who are like, fuck you, Tim Ferriss, you know what the fuck you're talking about, you stupid piece of shit, how dare you?
Oh yeah, thousands.
And so do you just kind of write that off, or do you, you know, is there anything constructive that you do with it?
I would say that there's a lot of very valid criticism that comes through, and mm-hmm. I try to dismiss the tone. First of all, I don't read most of the comments on the internet about me. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good policy.
Okay.
It's like if you go to TechCrunch or YouTube and you expect to gain something from reading your comments,
oh no,
other than a new prescription for antidepressants,
never ever
you're wrong.
Do that.
So don't read your comments outside of your living room, which is how I view my blog. But when I do get feedback and I ask for feedback, I try to look at whether it is valuable and dismiss the tone first. Secondly, if people hate me, which is there are plenty of them who do for mostly reasons I don't understand, I won't address it unless there's some huge factual discrepancy.
Okay.
So if they accuse me of something that's completely fictional,
mm-hmm.
in some cases, I will respond to it. Not in all cases, because I think starving things of oxygen online is the most effective self-defense policy.
Yeah. Of course.
Because if you're like, that's bullshit, man, I never did A, B, C, D, and E, and you link to it, oh my God, all right, you just gave that 5 more notches up on your Google results. And I tend to avoid it. But I also think it's very important to realize that you can't one of my rules in my like philosophical operating system is you can't reason someone out of a position they didn't reason themselves into.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Right? So whether it's religion, whether it's some type of dietary dogma, if they're not showing data forget it. Don't argue.
Mm-hmm.
It's a waste of time. So if someone gets up to me and they're, if someone stands up at a Q&A, and I've done this a few times, and they're like, you know what, what the fuck do you mean about this? And that's bullshit because of this, this, and this. And they want to have a big debate. I say, is there anything that I could possibly say, any data I could possibly show you that would lead to you changing your mind? And if they're like, no, I'm like, okay, sit down. Next question. It's a waste of everyone's time.
Well, so because people write mostly when they're emotional,
yeah.
Which I always try to not to do because when you write when you're emotional, those are usually the ones that you regret.
Yeah.
And when people write something emotional, the times that I have responded and been like, oh, you know, this was seemed a little aggressive, and they're always like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I don't. Right. And I've been guilty of writing emotionally as well.
No, this is a really important point. So what I've noticed also is if you have, let's just say, a spectrum. So you have a line that represents your fans and haters, and in the very middle, there's completely neutral.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the people who absolutely, almost to a scary extent, love you.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other hand, to a scary extent, hate you.
Mm-hmm.
People at those two poles switch places really easily.
Oh, yeah.
It's something I've noticed. And both sides are equally dangerous. So I would say that whenever if I have criticism on the blog, and I have tons of criticism on the blog, I try to make sure that it's civil because I do treat, there's enough negativity in the world. I don't want to invite it into my living room. It, like I said, as I view my blog comments, and I don't want to encourage people to abuse each other. If they attack me, that's fine. If they attack each other, then they get deleted. It's very, right. very civil. Where was I going with that? If I respond to them, then I try to respond very, very calmly. And I'm like, look, sorry you're disappointed. I'm sorry you feel that way. Here are two blogs I'd recommend you read instead. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish you well, Tim Ferriss. And like you said, 8 times out of 10, they're like, oh shit, dude, I'm sorry. I lost my job. I got drunk and had a huge argument with my girlfriend. Like I was being a dick. I'm sorry. Or they completely flip and they're like, oh my God, all right, you responded, cool, you're awesome, now I'm your best friend. And then they become a diehard evangelist.
And they're like, you didn't respond, fuck you again.
Yeah.
Like,
oh. Yeah. Or if you have a diehard fan and they feel like you've slighted them, they will become your worst enemy.
Right.
And I think being aware of that's very helpful.
It's all that, just any kind of passion, the love passion or the hate passion.
But we've dominated your time enough, but this was phenomenal.
This was phenomenal.
This was fun, man.
I'm so glad that we finally were able to get you on the podcast. I know you're about to travel some more. And
my pleasure, man.
So glad I can have pink packets of artificial sweet.
and sugar-free jelly.
Yes.
It is pretty delicious, I will say.
Yeah. Especially
and then
the tropical flavor.
I have to get off chai latte somehow.
Damn it!
Go order the mat.
Baby steps. Baby steps out of the office. Baby steps down the hallway.
To the elevator.
Only thing left in my life. Chai lattes. Fuck!
Dr. Leo Marvin is...
I'm sailing! Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Enjoy your burrito bowl with no rice.
This is true. Thank you. Thank you.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Nancy's love story could have been ripped right out of the pages of one of her own novels.
She was a romance mystery writer who happens to be married to a chef.
But this story didn't end with a happily ever after.
When I stepped into the kitchen, I could see that Chef Brophy was on the ground, and I heard somebody say, call 911.
As writers, we'd written our share of murder mysteries. So when suspicion turned to Dan's wife, Nancy, we weren't that surprised.
The first person they look at would be the spouse.
We understand that's usually the way they do it.
But we began to wonder, had Nancy gotten so wrapped up in her own novels...
There are murders in all of the books.
...that she was playing them out in real life? You can listen to Happily Never After, Dan and Nancy, early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.